Position number 13152, Rule 5.
Wing Commander Parrot, Rule 5.
All right. Well, we carried on, and we didn't see anything else of any particular note, except for the first time I looked round over my shoulder because I thought something was going on behind me. There had been a bit of angry flak from one of the ports farther south. I can't remember which one now, probably Dieppe. And I saw a whole string of these nasty red bulls chasing after me, which, of course, was... I suppose their version of the Swedish gun we had.
Bofors.
Bofors, yeah. And anyway, it was a very nasty feeling. These things tried to catch me up, but they didn't anyway. But there was a string of them, about half a dozen or more. It was early in the morning, and I think it was probably a grey day. That's why they shone out so brightly. Anyway, we got back, and the intelligence officer came along, who was one of my masters at school. Another Dusty Miller, strangely enough. And we had a book of ship silhouettes, which we were studied, and which I had studied, actually, with considerable care. And I'd picked up quite a few points on assessing the tonnage that a ship might be, usually from counting the number of derricks it had and where the bridge was and, you know, things like that, and they were quite accurate. Anyway, I thought this thing in Boulogne was about 2,000 tons, but we had been told that it was unlikely that we should be seeing anything more than 500 tons, and there is a tendency among pilots who are new to the game of over-assessing the tonnage of ships. When we came back, I'd looked at this thing pretty carefully. It had one pair of derricks, I think it was, on me, and a forehead. Then there was a bridge, and then there was another derrick behind the bridge. I think something like that, anyway. And it fitted one of the 2,000-ton silhouette very well. Well, when we got back, the intelligence officer came along and he said, well, what? He was telling me about the ship. He said, well, what size do you think it was? You see, I said, oh, well, you go first, Ken. You're the flight commander. And he said, no, you go first. I'll reserve mine. And I thought, well, I'm going to be bloody careful here. If it's over 500 tons, it's worth going after, and I'm sure it's worth going after. I mustn't over-assess. So I said, it's 800 tons, I think. And Ken came in straight away and said, oh, no, nothing like it, 500 tons. Well, they sent out one squadron of Typhoons to deal with this thing, and they were livid when they came back. They should have had about three squadrons on it. It was a 2,000-tonner. So we weren't very popular with the Tiffins for a little while. But anyway, a few days after that, I was posted again abroad, and out I went to, via Algiers to Malta.
And this was 1435 squadron?
That's right, yep. Yep. Commanding officer Dick Webb, a New Zealander.
What was the journey to Malta like?
We had to do submarine lookout watches. It was a troop ship. It was a banana boat. Meat boat it was, an Argentinian meat boat. Clan line. Clan princess. Clan queen, something like that. Nice ship with all the refrigeration, of course. The food was super, and white bread and lots of butter and super, but dry. It took about 10 days, I think it was, to get down to Algiers, because we had to go right out in the Atlantic and then come back in again. Cabin, two tiers of three bunks each, so there's six of us in a cabin, which were pretty tight. Not a lot more to say. Oh, I lost some of my clothes again. One of my bags went missing on the train up to Greenock from the personnel depot where we assembled. Anyway.
So you got to Malta without running into the enemy?
Oh, yes, 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 no problems. To Algiers, and then we were flown by American Dakotas from Algiers along to Tripoli and then across to Malta.
This is July 43?
Yes, that's right, yeah. And I was put in 1435 squadron. The group captain operations in Malta was Dusty Miller, who was the squadron commander of 145, who hadn't been allowed to lead his own squadron. He came along and recognised me straight away, which was rather surprising because I'd only known him a few days. And he said, "You don't want to stay stuffing around here, Peter. They're all out in, all into Sicily now. You know, the 10 days after the invasion of Sicily, or a week after." So, being a dutiful chap, I was quite happy with 1435. It seemed rather a soft billet, but I said, "Yes, of course, I want to go on, sir." And I was on an aeroplane the next day to Sicily, where I was greeted by. The bloody Scottish sheep farmer. Anyway, I'll think of his name. He was a great chap, the group captain. He asked me about my background, which I gave him, and he said, "Well, I'll put you into 72 squadron to start with." The squadron commander, a young chap, he's a brilliant pilot, and younger than you, but I don't suppose you'll know him, you see, and so off I went to. He said, "His name's Daniel." And I thought, "Daniel, yeah, I had a pupil named Daniel, that'd be him." I went off. Sure enough, it was the pupil I'd had 18 months previously, and this chap in that time had gained a DSO and a DFC and bar, and had made himself a squadron leader from being from being a sergeant pilot. He was commissioned, he'd have been a cadet, non-commissioned to cadet, and then got his commission at the end of the course. Yeah. Oh, Danny Daniel. He wasn't very pleased to see that. He was a bit embarrassed. Well, so was I. But it was only for a few days, and I was given a flight in 111 Squadron.
This is Pacino Falcone?
Yes. Yeah.
Pacino Falcone is the name of a place in Sicily.
Well, we went to three or four strips on Sicily. I don't know why we moved around, but we did. And then we went to Falcone, which is a point on the north east side of Sicily. Oh, we had one interesting scrap while we were there. I can't remember where we were flying from when we had it. We were doing a patrol over the Straits of Messina. Must have been somebody going across. I don't know. Something was happening. Anyway, it was a mixed bunch of Mackie 2002s or something. I can't remember what the figure was now. It was a low-wing monoplane. It was the Italian, latest Italian fighter. There were a few of those, and some 109s, a very mixed bunch, about 20 of them. And they were coming down. We picked them up just as they were, I don't know if they'd been doing some, drop some bombing, bombs or anything, but they headed northeast as hard as they could go when they saw us coming. We caught them up. I caught up with a Mackie, and my number two was stayed with me, a Canadian. There are a lot of old volcanic craters behind on the toe of Italy. Have you been down that way? Do you know?
No.
And they're quite high, but they're these huge craters, volcanic craters. And this chap went down into one of these craters. Followed by me. It was about a mile across, I suppose, or maybe a bit more. And he was going round just below the rim of this crater. And I was in behind him, and my number two was being behind me. And I could just about get a bead on, because there was a bit of deflection. We were turning pretty sharply, but I just got enough on. And we went three-quarters of the way round this volcano crater, and he hit the ground on the on the third cardinal point. Jake and I came up out of it. He'd had a few shots at it, but he was a bit frightened of firing in case he hit me. And we never saw any more fighters then until we started doing patrols over Salerno. And they went on for quite a long time. I've forgotten how many I did now. It was two a day, nearly every day for, I don't know, about 10 days, I think, or more maybe.
What were they like?
Well, we had to carry 90-gallon drop tanks with us to get us there and give us about a 35-minute patrol time. 244 wing were also doing the same thing, so there were about 10 squadrons, I suppose, engaged on it.
Was there much enemy flak or fighters?
Not a lot. I went down after one fighter, and it turned out to be a wretched American Mustang. And it shows how the power of strength can come into you if you really want to get rid of something. The drop tank, it was supposed, I think it was a maximum, I know there was a maximum speed for dropping it, I think I've forgotten what it was now, it was under 200 miles an hour. Anyway, I got my nose down after this thing, which I thought was a 109, and there was a sort of D-shaped handle down here which you pulled up to release the drop tank, and I wanted to go faster after this thing, and I was tugging and tugging and tugging, and I pulled the ring in half. It didn't break the lever, it broke the ring itself. So I had half a D-ring in my hand, which surprised the airmen, ground chaps, when I got back. that was one. The other one was a Dornier we came across, and that I and somebody else latched onto it, and we went after it, and it went like hell. And again, so the bay at Salerno has a ring of hills, very high hills around it. I don't know what they are, 3,000 or 4,000 feet, I think, 3,000 feet. This Dornier, we saw him, he just scraped the ridge. It was the dust and rocks flying. And by that time, we were getting short of fuel, and I couldn't follow anymore. I wasn't in range to shoot at him. He was going too far. Whether he fell out of the sky on the other side of the hill, I don't know. I didn't see him again, that's for sure. What excitements were there? Not a lot.
Did you do any strafing of ground?
No, we weren't required at that time to do any strafing. That came much later. Our sole job was to maintain the mastery of the skies. They keep it clear from the Germans, because they still had aircraft around. They were pretty good at avoiding us. I guess they had observation points to tell them to stay out of the way. The fighters are there at the moment, and now there's a gap between the one lot coming and going and the other lot coming. It was a fairly easy operation for them to use their aircraft that way. The Navy had an aircraft carrier there as well, or maybe two, I'm not sure. And I saw a Monitor for the first and only time, which is almost a round ship. Do you know the Monitor?
Yes.
Yes, they had Monitor there, shelling at Salerno. Well, then, having established that, we flew up to Salerno and were on airstrips there for a time. Again, they were sort of rather routine patrols, occasional bomber escorts, and sort of sweeps around to try and stir up something, you know, or pick off something which might have strayed into the wrong area, anything like that. It was rather... You know, we didn't seem to be doing anything very, very, very constructive, really, or destructive, perhaps, is a better word. But anyway, then we moved up to Naples, to Capodichino. That was the next time.
This is 43 Squadron.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I went up with Treble One, and a few days after we got there, I was switched to. 43 Squadron is commanding officer, yeah. Funnily enough, going back to Malta, Dick Webb, the squadron commander there, we were having a beer when not long after I'd arrived. And I was a flight attendant, and he was a squadron lead. And he said, you know, Peter, the promotion out here is terribly slow. It took me 16 months before I got to be a squadron leader from flight lieutenant. I'd been a flight lieutenant for 2 years already. But that was the fault of training command, of course. There was no promotion there, not very little. Yes, and then commanding your own squadron, that is the... I don't know, I think it's the finest job in the Air Force.
Marvelous. Right.
You've got the camaraderie, you've got a certain amount of freedom of action. You go about it the right way, you've got the respect of a fair number of people, and you can have an awful lot of fun. But also, I mean, the responsibility, what was I then? I was... 23, 44, yes, 23, that's right, yeah. Anyway.
What kind of work did you have to do in the Naples area?
Well then, of course, we were doing some patrols around the operational area. Then, of course, it wasn't long before Anzio started. And so we were patrolling over Anzio for every day, two or three times a day. We were only met the Germans there once, and they were on their way home pretty well before we... No, they were out over the shipping, that's right, and we intercepted them out at sea. But they'd finished with the shipping and they were going north, and so it was a hell of a chase. And they were the fighters, the FW-190s, and we couldn't catch them. We arrived just too late. It was as we came up. The Americans were there at the same time, and one of their ruddy kitty hawks hit my number two, got his oil pipe. The engine lasted out till we got back, thank God. No, somebody else was damaged because he bailed out over the sea. A Dutch destroyer picked him up. He'd been in the water 5 minutes and he was dead. And that was bad luck. Well, then I lost a pilot on a silly one when we were coming back from a sweep or an escort or something, and usual thing, you know, signal them into close formation to come over the airfield before landing. And one of the lads came skidding in to take up formation and hit his leader. Leader bailed out. The other lad was killed, which was rather sad. Right. Escorts. Christmas Day.
1943.
I was pulled out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you know, nobody ever flew on Christmas Day. The Germans didn't fly on Christmas Day. I don't think they did much fighting on Christmas Day. But while we were at Naples, we were under the control of the 3rd American Air Force, General Joe Cannon. And the Desert Air Force on the other side of the of Italy had an American Air Force wing doing things for them. And I was pulled out about 6 o'clock in the morning to go and do a weather test. So I got another two aircraft, so I got another chap. And off we went. And I said it was bloody silly. I argued, actually. I rang up the operations officer at 3rd Air Force and said, this is ridiculous. Nobody's flying on Christmas Day. There's a cloud cover at about 3,000 or 4,000 feet. I mean, very thick too, obviously. And, you know, there are no aids to navigation for fighter pilots in those days. But out there, anyway. And I argued like hell, and I got onto Duncan Smith, who by this time was the group captain, And he said, well, I'll have a word with him, you see. And he rang up the operations officer. He rang me back and he said, no, you better go, Peter. So I said, all right. And off I went with somebody, I can't remember who now. And we went up, we took off, and we'd got not more than 5 miles north of the airfield. And the controller came up, mission abandoned, return to base. And I was so angry on a Christmas morning. The one thing I wanted to do was get on the telephone and tell the operations officer what I thought of him, or the controller, either of them. Anyway, I came steaming down, taxiing down beside the runway on Cavaticino Airfield. And blow me down, I did the thing you must not do. I chewed up the wing of another chap's Spitfire. In fact, it was the squadron commander of 92. It was his own personal Spitfire. And the flight sergeant came out and looking rather... He didn't look at all sad, actually. He looked quite happy. And I got out and I said, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm sorry, flight. No, I'm giving you a bit of work. This was the 92 squadron flight sergeant. He said, don't worry, sir, I'm pleased to see that. I've been trying to get rid of that damned aircraft for the years and the CO won't let it go. The group captain came round in the evening for a drink and I said, I'm sorry, sir, I've made a bit of a mess of two airplanes. And he looked at me and said, you bloody fool. Left it at that. And I got a red endorsement in my logbook in the end, but I've torn that out now. So, other excitements. Well, then we started ANZIO, I think. And I told you
Were the patrols over ANZIO just the same as over Salerno, or is it much different?
Oh, it's much closer. We didn't need extra drop tanks then. No, it's much closer. Much easier. And the Americans were in on that as well. They had quite a lot of aeroplanes as well, so we probably had a slightly easier time. There was one evening we'd just landed, we still had a fair amount of fuel in our tanks, I think. And we were right on the edge of the sea. We were in it was a duck preserve. We'd moved from Cavaticino. We'd gone up north of Naples, where there's a long sandy stretch of beach. And it's a very marshy place, but they'd put a strip there. And it was one of the King of Italy's duck shooting preserves. My warrant officer used to go out duck shooting, which was great because he came along to the mess occasionally, going for the CO, which is great. And anyway, we just landed. We were looking out to sea, and suddenly there were 190s and things flying up there, going like hell, going north again. They'd been down as far as Naples and done a bit of strafing or dropping bombs there. And I jumped back in my aeroplane. I think one or two others did. There was nothing sort of on by telephone or anything like that. We just saw them going. And I got off the ground very quickly. And I was another of these long stern chases, and I couldn't catch this. And I gave him a parting gift at long range, but I don't think I touched anything. Oh, there was one, yes, there was one other action before Salerno. It must have been after Salerno. It was during the casino trying to take casino. And we were on patrol. It was earlier because when we were still at Cavaticino, so it was before ANZIO. We were on patrol near the Frosinone, the southern end of the Frosinone Valley, which is where Monte Cassino is. One of the chaps spotted some aircraft. I mean, I had to get him to lead me on, read me round to them. And then I got them, and we did. We got in among about 10, I suppose, or a dozen 109s. And we got, they were going like hell. We couldn't catch the front ones. We came up with the rearmost ones. I think we shot four of them down. Again, I could see my bullets hitting the ones I was aiming at, but they didn't seem to take much notice of them. Well, I know what, my cannons wouldn't work. That was the trouble. I only had four machine guns.
No.
And I wasn't a very good shot anyway.
You had one other squadron command during the war, according to the record you
filled
out
right.
for me here,
yeah.
which was 72 squadron in 44-45.
That's right.
Can you tell me about that period at Rimini, please?
Yep. I'd been down to Egypt on rest, having completed my second tour of operations. And I came back. In fact, I wrote to Duncan Smith and asked him to send for me, which he did after 6 months. And I was given... I arrived at Florence. The wing was at Florence at this stage. And they had just come back from southern France. And I was supernumerary with 90... Well, I wasn't supernumerary. I just went and stayed with 92 Squadron, whose squadron commander was a guy who'd been one of my gunnery instructors down in Egypt. He'd come back a bit earlier, South African. And then the wing moved to Rimini. And the day we got there, I took over command of 72 Squadron from a chap named Arthur, Duke Arthur, a Canadian, who was another old friend I'd known a long time before. And we were doing armed reconnaissance over the lines, and we did a bit of strafing, I think. At some stage we did a bit of strafing. I can't remember where it was now. It was crossing a river. Anyway, that was quite something. We were given a field to shoot up on the north bank of the river. So down we went. I was leading it, I know, so I must have been... I think it must have been 43 Squadron. Didn't see anything at all. Didn't see any German troops, but this was the exact pinpoint we were supposed to shoot up, which we did. Then, not long after that, they strapped 500-pound bombs on our Spitfires. And we went back to the old army close support business. German positions, anything up to 5-10 miles behind the lines. We sometimes did deeper penetrations on reconnaissance. I could never find anything, and I don't know. I don't think I had the knack of picking things out on the ground. It's a difficult thing. We went round at about 7,000 feet, which is quite high, because any lower and you're going to get shot at pretty badly by rack. We never found anything, and we used to drop our bombs in fairly close proximity to where we knew there were German troops or German troops.